Discerning Hearts presents The Ascent of Mount Carmel by St. John of the Cross, translated by David Lewis and read by Ed Humpel. Book 2, Chapter 8, which describes, in a general way, how no creature and no knowledge that can be comprehended by the understanding can serve as approximate means of divine union with God.
Before I discuss the proper and fitting means of union with God, which is faith, it is right that I should show how that no created or imagined thing can subserve the intellect as a proper means for its union with God, and how everything which the intellect embraces, if it does but cleave to it, becomes a hindrance instead of help. In this chapter I shall show this in general, and afterwards I shall do so in particular, going through all sorts of knowledge which the intellect may receive through the senses, both exterior and interior, and the inconveniences and losses it may sustain through all such knowledge, because it does not proceed in reliance on the proper means, which is faith. It is a principle of philosophy that all means must be proportionate to the end, having a certain fitness and resemblance to it, such as shall be sufficient for the object in view. For instance, a person wishes to reach a certain city. He must necessarily travel along the road, which is the means leading to it. Likewise, if you wish to combine and unite together wood and fire, in that case it is requisite that heat, that is, the means, should so dispose the wood and raise it to such a degree of heat that it shall have a great resemblance and proportion to fire. If you attempt this by any other than the proper means, which is heat, as, for instance, by air, water, or earth, it will be impossible to unite wood with fire. So therefore, if the intellect is to be united with God, so far as that is possible in this life, it must, of necessity, make use of those means which can effect that union, and which are most like unto God. But remember, among all creatures, the highest and the lowest, there is not one that comes near unto God, or that bears any likeness to his substance. For, though it be true, as theologians tell us, that all creatures bear a certain relation to God, and are tokens of his being, some more, some less, according to the greater or less perfection of their nature, yet there is no essential likeness or communion between them and him. Yea, rather the distance between his divine nature and their nature is infinite. Hence, then, it is impossible for the intellect to attain perfectly unto God by means of created things, whether of heaven or of earth, because there is no proportion of similitude between them. Thus David, speaking of the heavenly host, cries out, "There is none among the gods like unto thee, O Lord." The gods are the holy angels and the souls of the saints. And again, "Thy way, O God, is the holy way. Who is the great God like our God?" That is, the way to thee, O God, is a holy way, namely, pureness of faith. Who is the great God like our God? Who is the saint so high in glory, or the angel so exalted by nature, that it can be a way proportionate and sufficient for us to attain unto God? The same prophet, speaking of the things of heaven and earth together, saith, "The Lord is high and looketh on the low, and the high he knoweth afar off." That is, God high in his own being, seeth that the things of the earth are in themselves most vile and low, in comparison with himself. And the high, the heavenly host, he knoweth to be far distant from him. No creature, therefore, can be a proportionate means of perfect union with God. So also nothing that the imagination may conceive or the intellect comprehend in this life is or can be approximate means of union with God. For, if we speak of natural knowledge, The intellect is incapable of comprehending anything unless it be presented to it under forms and images by the bodily senses. And these forms of things, as I have already said, cannot serve as means, and no natural acts of the intellect can in any way contribute thereto. Again, if we speak of supernatural acts, as far as possible in this life, the intellect in its bodily prison has neither the disposition nor the capacity requisite for the reception of the clear knowledge of God. This knowledge is not of this life, for we must either die or remain without it. Thus God said to Moses, "Man shall not see me and live." And St. John saith the same, "No man hath seen God at any time." St. Paul, too, repeats the words of Isaiah, "Eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, nor hath it entered into the heart of man." This is the reason why Moses at the bush durst not behold God being there present. He knew that his intellect could not proportionately contemplate God, though this sprung from the deep sense he had of God. Elias, our father, covered his face on the mountain in the presence of God. By that action he taught us that he made his intellect blind, not venturing to apply an instrument so vile to a matter so high, and that he perceived clearly that however much he saw or understood, all would be most unlike unto God and far distant from him. No knowledge, therefore, and no understanding in this mortal life can serve as proximate means of this high union of the love of God. All that the intellect may comprehend, all that the will may be satisfied with, and all that the imagination may conceive, is most unlike unto God, and the most disproportionate to him. This truth is admirably expressed by the prophet. To whom have you likened God? And what image will you make for him? Hath the workman cast a graven statue? Or hath the goldsmith formed it with gold, or the silversmith with plates of silver? The workman is the intellect, which fashions our knowledge, and cleanses it from the iron of sensitive impressions and fancy. The goldsmith is the will, which is capable of receiving the forms and figures of pleasure, caused by the gold of love wherewith it loves. The silversmith, which cannot represent God with plates of silver, is the memory with the imagination, the notions and conceptions of which are well described as plates of silver. The prophet then says, in other words, the intellect by speculation cannot comprehend anything which is like unto God. No delight or satisfaction of the will can resemble that which is God, nor can the memory furnish the imagination with any notions or images to represent him. It is evident, then, from this that the intellect cannot be immediately directed in the way of God by any knowledge such as this, and that, if it is to draw near unto God, it must do so by not understanding rather than by seeking to understand. Yea, rather must it be by making itself blind, covering itself with darkness, and not by opening its eyes, that it can attain to the divine enlightening. Hence it is that contemplation, by which God enlightens the intellect, is called mystical theology, that is, the secret wisdom of God, because it is a secret even to the intellect which receives it. Saint Dionysius calls it a ray of darkness. And the prophet Baruch thus speaks of it, "The way of wisdom they have not known, neither have they remembered her paths." It is therefore clear that the intellect must be blind as to every path along which it has to travel in order to be united with God. Aristotle says that as the eyes of the bat are with regard to the sun, which wholly blinds them, so is our intellect with regard to the greater light of God, which is to us perfect darkness. He further says that the more profound and the clearer the things of God are in themselves, the less intelligible and the more obscure they are to us. The Apostle says the same thing when he teaches us that the deep things of God are not known unto men. I should never end were I to bring forward here all the authorities and reasons which show that, among all created things of which the intellect takes cognizance, there is nothing which can serve as a ladder, whereby it may ascend unto God, who is so high. Yea, rather we must acknowledge that all and each of these things, if the intellect will use them as proximate means of union, will prove not only a hindrance, but the source of many errors and delusions in the ascent of this mountain.
Book 2, Chapter 9. How Faith is the Proximate and Proportionate Means to the Understanding, whereby the soul may attain to the divine union of love. This is proved by passages and figures from divine scripture.
It appears from what I have written that the intellect, if rightly disposed for the divine union, must be pure and empty of all sensible objects, disengaged from all clear intellectual perceptions, interiorly tranquil and at rest, reposing on faith. For faith is the sole proximate and proportionate means of the soul's union with God, seeing that there is no other alternative, but that God is either seen or believed in. For as God is infinite, so faith proposes Him as infinite. And as He is three and one, so faith proposes Him to us as three and one. And thus, by this means alone, that is, faith, God manifests Himself to the soul in the divine light, which surpasses all understanding, and therefore the greater the faith of the soul, the more is that soul united to God. This is the meaning of St. Paul when he said, "He that cometh to God must believe that he is." Such a one must walk by faith, with his understanding in darkness, and in the obscurity of faith only. For in this darkness God unites himself to the intellect, being himself hidden beneath it, as it is written, "Darkness was under his feet, and he ascended upon the cherubim, and he flew upon the wings of the winds. And he made darkness his covert, his pavilion round about him, dark waters in the clouds of the air." The darkness under his feet, serving for his covert, and his pavilion, and the dark waters, signify the obscurity of faith, which conceals him. His ascending on the cherubim, and his flying on the wings of the winds, signify that he transcends all understanding. The cherubim mean those who understand or contemplate. The wings of the winds are the sublime and lofty notions or conceptions of the mind, above which his divine being is, and which no man can ever comprehend. This truth is shadowed forth in the Holy Scriptures, where we read that when Solomon had finished the temple, God came down in a cloud, which filled it, so that the people could not see. Then Solomon said, "The Lord said that he would dwell in a cloud." Moses also, on the mount, saw a cloud wherein God was hidden. And at all times, when God communicated with men, he appeared through a cloud. We read in the book of Job that God spoke out of the darkened air. The Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind. These clouds signify the obscurity of faith, in which God is hidden when he communicates himself to the soul. This will be removed at that time to which St. Paul referred when he said, "When that which is perfect is come, that which is in part shall be done away." When that which is in part, the obscurity of faith, shall be done away, and when that which is perfect, the divine light, shall come. This is prefigured in the army of Gideon. The soldiers had lamps in their hands, which they saw not, because they were within the pitchers. But when they had broken the pitchers, the lamps gave light. Gideon gave them trumpets in their hands, and empty pitchers, and lamps within the pitchers. So faith, of which these pitchers were a figure, contains the divine light, that is, the truth which God is. And at the end of this mortal life, when the work of faith is over, and the pitchers are broken, the light and glory of God will then shine forth. It is therefore plain that the soul, which would in this life be united with God and commune immediately with Him, must unite itself to Him in the cloud, where, according to Solomon, He has promised to dwell, and in the obscure air, wherein He was pleased to reveal His secrets to Job, and take up the pitchers of Gideon, that it may hold in its hands, in the acts of the will, that faith which is the union of love, through the obscurity of faith, so that, so soon as the pitcher of life be broken, it may see God face to face in glory. It remains for me now to describe particularly those notions and apprehensions which the intellect admits, the hindrance and the inquiry they may inflict upon us in the way of faith, and how the soul must be disposed with respect to them, so that they may be profitable rather than hurtful, both those which proceed from the sense, as well as those which proceed from the Spirit.